Good morning, Al.
Hey, good morning, Karen. Good morning, everyone. I do, it'll surprise everybody I know, but I do like Three Little Birds and Bird on a Wire. So I just, I like Surf and Bird, and boy, I guess pretty much anything with a bird as a word in it I like. But those are great songs. Hey, I want to thank everybody at St. John's Campus in Albert Lea for allowing me to come in and babble to them a little bit. They have a nest cam on an eagle there, but the eagle built two nests. So the one they put the camera on where they've nested before, now the eagle pair has moved to the other nest.
Well, so they don't want to be spied on. I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to.
Publicity shy, maybe they are. Yeah. I don't know. So now you're kind of in that conundrum, you know, next year, do you move it to the nest they were in this year, or are we bothering them by doing that? So maybe we shouldn't do it. So you put one on both of them, which, of course, is much more expensive. So who knows what will happen. I saw some, I led a walk on a Brookside Trail, and a bunch of wonderful folk came out. I'm always surprised how many show up. And as we were there, we looked at American white pelicans, and the pelicans, the upper mandible on most of them had developed a flattened, semicircular fibrous plate, like a horn, and it's called a nuptial tubercle. And birds mature enough to reproduce develop a nuptial tubercle, which falls off when the mating season is over. And it's unique to the American white pelican. None of the other pelicans that I am aware of species have this. And the size of the bump, some people call it a sail, because it sort of looks like a sail, is variable, and both sexes develop it. So both males and females have it. And its purpose is to make them more attractive to mates. Another thing that's interesting, once they go into molting into their kind of their eclipse plumage at the end of the breeding season, their crests turn gray, and their eye color changes from dark to light. So it's neat to see them, and boy, they were just, I don't know if they were exhausted or overfed, they just were right there, and we could look at them, and everybody could get to see those with their binoculars. Dina Penny Tritton of Keister said, Al, I wanted to tell you how excited I was to have a pileated woodpecker at my suet feeder this morning. Doug, who is Dina's late husband, Doug and I have never had one stop by before in the 36 years here. Sure wish he could have seen it. Of course, at just the time my Kindle camera focused, he took off. Randy Chirpik of Fairmont sent me some photos and video of a great blue heron, wood ducks, and pelicans. Thank you, Randy. Jane Agerdahl. Jane lives in Faribault. She said it was exciting to see new robin's eggs high under my back door awning each year. Living a block away from the Straight River, it's a wonderful place for birds. I watch mom and dad robin build the nest and be present together, giving chirps of alarm together when a feral cat walked by. Sadly, after three nights on her four eggs, a feral cat got daddy robin. Mom chirps and chirps for him during the breaks she takes when I'm going in and out my door. My question is, if both parents have a full-time job feeding four chicks, can one robin single parent feed all four? Can I help by putting some easily accessed grubs, mealworms, or anything to help see that she gets enough to eat plus feed all four hungry mouths once they hatch? If so, where I get these grubs, etc., and how would I display them? Any suggestion? Feral cats are such an issue around here. Jane, thanks for writing. The male doesn't have a brood patch, so he doesn't incubate the eggs. The female might continue to incubate, but may give up the nest because the chances of bringing off more than one or two nestlings is slight with just her to feed them. Oh. If she had been the one who had died, the eggs would fail because dad would not be able to, he wouldn't be able to do it. So for the first 4 days of a nestling's life, the parents regurgitate partly digested food into each baby's mouth. And I know some say that sounds disgusting. Well, I remember what we fed kids. Some of that was pretty disgusting too. Some of it was awfully good, that baby food. But by the time the little robins are 5 days of age, the nestlings get earthworms that the parents break into small mouthful, and the babies eat more each day, and soon the parents are giving them whole worms and large insects. So you could offer mealworms in plastic dishes or acrylic window feeders. There's no guarantee she'd go for it, but she might. A number of bird and pet stores sell them. And just use for an example, I was in Mankato on Sunday, and I stopped at Pet Expo, and they have mealworms and mealworm feeders there. So, and I'm sure a lot of other stores do. That just happened to be the one I stopped at. Tim Scott sent me something from the Washington Post. It says, "You've got to grab it while it's here." And it's a wonderful essay, and you need to grab it while it's here because soon it will be gone. And it's a life lesson taught by the flowers of the forest floor. And I've led spring ephemeral walks for, oh, I don't know how many years I did it, at Myrie Big Island State Park. And that's what I tell all the folks there. You got to come out and look at them quick because they're gone before we know it. Brad Lighting of Lake Crystal asked, he said, "You seeing these birds in the field? They fly up," and he's a farmer, and so he's out there doing things, and they fly up. He said, "They're dark above and light below. What could they be?" I would say they're horn larks, and you know, taking a stab here. But horn larks, we see there, we see them a lot this time of year. We do see them in the winter as well. Some hang around here all year. They're beautiful birds, and they do kind of have feathered horns on their head, but you wouldn't see that when they're flying up and down in the middle of the field unless you have binoculars or something. But that would be the ones that I would think those would be, Brad. Kent Spellman and Albert Lee said, "I'm seeing lots of cardinals this year." And he sent me something from Country Living magazine, and it says, "Because cardinals are private birds that favor dense tangles and often fly low and close to the tree line, seeing one should be considered a gift, according to Janet Ray Orth, a clairvoyant, intuitive, and energy healer who can communicate with animals. They are thus a symbol of optimism." I should talk to Janet Rayor sometime and see what all the animals are saying. That'd be, communicate with them. Richard Green says, "Al, I remember as a young boy up in Duluth in the early 1950s when I heard my first bittern. For several days, I thought I heard a water pump out in a swamp, only to eventually learn that it was a bittern. Several years later, I saw my first bittern among some cattails. It was standing with its beak straight up, swaying gently back and forth among the reeds, using movement as camouflage as it perfectly blended in with its flowing motion. What a wonderful world we live in." Amen, Richard. It's I remember as a kid hearing them. They're American bitterns, and we call them slew pump. Some people call them belcher, squelcher, and pile driver, all kinds of names they give that bird. But what a beautiful, beautiful bird. Mike Rucker said, "This past Saturday, my wife and I were driving about 5 miles north of Hadley, Minnesota." And some might be saying, "Where is Hadley?" I have a granddaughter named Hadley, so I know exactly where Hadley is. It's probably 5 miles out of Slayton. And Mike Rucker said, "I saw it through binoculars." I should say Hadley is, I don't know how many people are there, 50-some maybe, and I'm probably underestimating them, but there's not a lot. But they went with quality, so they're good folks. Mike Rucker again saw through his binoculars what appeared to be white-faced ibises. He said, according to the Merlin app, they were a bit east of their breeding range. "Have you had other reports of white-faced ibises in southern Minnesota? We also saw an osprey. It was a good day for birds." You know, it was April 19th. I had to look it up. I knew it was in April of last year. I got a call from the guy who manages a golf course in Albert Lee. It's called Green Lee Golf Course. And he said, we have these strange birds. There's a flock of birds. And I went down there, and they were white-faced ibises. So what beautiful birds. And it was neat to see them, and they were there for a few days. Rod Meyer sent me something from USA Today about a blue rock thrush. Blue rock thrush. Reportedly spotted on the Oregon coast, a fellow by the name of Michael Sanchez had traveled from Vancouver, Washington to Northwest Oregon last week to take photographs of waterfowls, not bird, waterfowls. And he happened to notice a small bird he took as nothing more than a common blackbird. It seemed to be a good subject as any for him to practice his photography skills. So he's just taking photos of this little bird out there. And he said before the lighting got good enough to start snapping some waterfall photos, he took more photos of this bird. But when he got back home to Vancouver, began processing his photos, he realized it was no mere blackbird that he had photographed. Its blue and chestnut colors mystified Sanchez, who was prompted to post his photos on Facebook. And the bird, again, it's a blue rock thrush. Huh. It's widely believed to, well, it's a native of Europe and Asia. And I should add, it's widely believed to be a blue rock thrush, but I'm going to say that's what it is. It has rarely, if ever, been spotted in North America. And I'd say rarely, if ever, is once. It was spotted in British Columbia in 1997. No previous records exist of this bird anywhere in the U.S. It's possible the bird accidentally migrated in the fall down the west coast of North America instead of the east coast of Asia if it was blown off its course by a storm. And you'd think if it would show up anywhere, maybe Alaska, because it's a bird that's in Russia.
I just looked at the picture of it. It is an absolutely beautiful bird, and I wish I had some in my backyard. Yeah. And so is it becoming extinct or anything, or is it just in the wrong place? Is that the main thing?
Just in the wrong place.
Okay.
And I'm sure we've all been lost, and you just this is probably what that bird is doing, is saying, where is everybody? You know, there should be more of me here, and yet I'm the only one here. I don't understand all this, so I hope it makes it back. I think it has been spotted since this article somewhere else along the coast, so they say there's probably a pretty good chance it's the same bird. So there'll probably be more records of this now.
Well, if it's on its own, though, what is the chance of survival? Because don't they sort of need to fly in flocks to survive, or shouldn't that matter?
He can move if he has enough time, and if his mind comes around to say, oh, gosh, this is how I get home. And they have that wonderful GPS in their brain, so I'm hoping his is in working order and charged up and everything so he can make it. TJ of St. Peter said, finally found my first brown snake of the year last week. And I know a lot of folks listening are saying, whew, finally. It's funny, I always say snakes are like lutefisk. People either love them or they don't care much for them. But TJ found it under a flat rock along the Minnesota River by St. Peter. He said, for such a lame nun winter, it seems like the reptiles and amphibians are showing up pretty much on schedule. With the rains and 70-degree temps coming up, the big spotted fox snakes will be emerging too from their underground hibernation dens. Look for them in and around the edge of the Minnesota River Valley.
Now, the fox snakes, I wanted to ask you, the fox snakes generally aren't in your yards, though, because the ones I generally see in the yard are the garter snakes, which are, you know, fine, but I've never actually come across a fox snake, so I'm wondering if that's just they're not in my yard.
No, and again, probably not a whole lot. So
okay.
The edge of the Minnesota River Valley, though, is still kind of where you'll see them. And they're the ones that can rattle a little bit and cause people to say it's a rattlesnake.
Oh, okay.
So I guess people aren't always happy to see them, and they're big snakes. I think they're beautiful snakes, but they draw people's attention, I guess, when you see one. Dean Musing sent photos of Canada geese on a roof, and also of goslings and a bluebird. Dean says, I've never seen geese perched on a house before. A good place for a view, but wondering if there's any particular reason for it. The bluebirds seem to have won the rights to the birdhouse. I am grateful for the beautiful day and all us critters that are in it. Me too, Dean. Yeah, if you think of a rooftop, it provides plenty of flat and open space with a good view of potential predators and the surrounding habitat. They offer some security since most of a flock's predators are ground-based. And so these same factors make rooftops appealing to nesting geese. So sometimes they will nest on roofs. They also nest in trees on occasion. So I think they probably think of a roof as an odd but useful tree. And say, well, yeah, this will work out for us. Just heard from Roger Davidson. Thank you, Roger. He said, I had a male flicker passing my way yesterday. A great-looking bird. I'm getting residents in the birdhouses this spring. Lots of action. So I'm glad to hear that, and I agree they are. And Mike Rucker said, heard and identified a cowbird's call. Wow, very different. Sounds like somebody gargling water. Is the American bittern's call similar? No, theirs is more of a like they're having difficulty swallowing something to me. And again, everybody's ear is different. But yeah, the cowbirds, it's a gargling sound, and then they make another one that sounds like a big drop of water falling down. So they make a lot of really beautiful songs, and they're beautiful birds. We're not excited about seeing a whole bunch of them around because they lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, and one female cowbird can lay up to 40 eggs in the nests of other birds. So someone who walked with me at Meadowlark Prairie's Outdoor Lab in St. James asked, will swans chase away Canada geese? Only a mature mated territorial nesting pair of trumpeter swans will chase off geese and other waterfowl in their nesting waters. Oh, you know, maybe a young gander or something will just give it a shot to practice. But it's just that mated territorial pair. And it's usually this aggressive behavior is usually exhibited only during the nesting season, which begins in April. And if you've seen swans, you know they dwarf Canada geese. So if there's a battle there, you know who's going to win it. But swans and geese often coexist nicely, and it isn't unusual to see them swimming together. I've at times of the year, I've seen swans flocking with geese. Young swans, or just say two female swans or two male swans in a pond, they will not be aggressive and generally tolerate geese and other waterfowl at any time of the year. You know, overall, I'd say swans get along famously with other species. So swans would tend to discourage geese from getting too close, especially when they have babies, when they have cygnets. However, I wouldn't say they usually force geese to leave the water, except maybe if it's a small farm pond where there's just not room for both of them. But they aren't bad. And I know a lot of places, especially in the eastern part of this country, they brought in swans, usually mute swans, in the hopes that they would chase geese out. And they probably had some success, but I don't know how much. And mute swans are an invasive species, so they don't. We still see them once in a while in Minnesota, though. Listener said, how can I tell if a ladybug is a multicolored lady beetle or one of our native beetles? Yeah, the multicolored lady beetle, and that's the one we all have in our house now. If we look at all the windows, especially in the garage, maybe we're going to see some of them there.
And they stink.
They do, and they're originally from Asia, and they were first released for biological control of other insects in this country. there's always some argument of, you know, whose fault was it? When was it done? It sounds like the first release was way back in 1916.
Oh, wow.
And it's not known for certain whether the Lady Beatles were able to establish themselves in the U.S., if that resulted from accidental entries into this country, planned releases, or probably both. And the Beatles' color ranges from yellow to orange to red, and a lot of things I know, if you look online, it says they have 19 spots. Well, they can have zero spots, and they can have anywhere in between, and they're black spots, and sometimes they're real faded. So, and the wings could even be entirely black with red spots. So all those are the reason that it includes multicolored in its name. But a consistent pattern is a black M on a white plate right behind its head, just above the wings. And it could be an M or a W, depending on whether you're the beetle is viewed from the front or the rear. But that's the thing you look for that will tell you it is indeed a multicolored Asian lady beetle. What bird lays the most eggs? And I bet you'd like to hear what wild bird would lay the most eggs, and I don't know. It seems like it might be an Australian or New Zealand bird that mounds, but I will look that up. But I do know, being an old chicken guy, that in 1979, the College of Agriculture at the University of Missouri, a white leghorn laid 371 eggs. In one thing I read, one study, it said it was in 364 days. Another one said 365. I'm going to say 365. Why would you stop one day short of a year in your study? This super chicken laid an egg a day for 448 consecutive days.
Wow.
448 days. That poor hen. We had a lot of hens. We had a laying house, but we had a lot of free-range chickens, too. And, boy, you know, they wouldn't come anywhere close to that. What does the average laying hen lay in these big houses we see? Depending on breed, I'm going to say 300 eggs a year around in there. And the same person asked, I have a sapsucker in my yard that's drilling holes in a tree. How can I stop it from doing that? I don't want to hurt the bird. I just want it to drill holes in somebody else's tree. Yeah, that's not in my yard. Yeah. Wrap the targeted area in burlap and do it over a wide enough section so the sapsucker won't just start a new ring of holes.
But Al, if they're doing that to the trees, doesn't mean there's some bugs or something in the tree, so the tree's infected or not?
No, the sapsucker is like we are. We want to get the sap out of the tree. So it is it's eating that sap. So it'll come back every so often to check the sap wells, because those things will keep running, so it'll eat some, and then it'll go off to do whatever sapsuckers do when they're not eating, and then come back and eat a little more.
Can it kill the tree, then, if they could do enough holes?
You know, if it was a small tree and it got enough holes, I think what the big problem is that disease might get into it. But for the most part, a healthy tree survives it without anything more than an interesting tattoo. And also the ruby crown kinglet, the golden crown kinglet, eastern phoebe, yellow rump warbler, Cape May warbler, ruby-throated hummingbird, woodpeckers, other species, squirrels, moths, butterflies, and a lot of other things all feed on the sap or the insects found in the sap wells. So they do provide food for a lot of other things. And when the hummingbirds first come back, they stalk the sapsuckers, just follow them around till the sapsucker shows them where these drill holes are.
You know,
they
do it in such a neat manner, because they've pretty much done my pear trees, and the pear trees are dying anyway. I don't know if that's why. It's probably other reasons. But it's just like they have a little checkerboard, and they know exactly where to put these. And it's almost like art when you see where they've drilled.
It is. It is, and I have a tree here that they haven't come to for several years now, but it just has, they say it has these tattoos or all the way around, like it's wearing a bunch of necklaces or something, and it's really quite attractive. I don't know how the tree feels about it, but I think it's just beautiful. So, and the tree seems to suffer no problems whatsoever there. So it was fun watching the sapsucker. He'd just come in, and then he'd look off to one side of the sap well and then take a look from the other side, and then all of a sudden the sap would come, and he was a happy, happy bird.
Hey, Al, I got a text from Jane in St. James, and I don't ever recall getting one from Jane before, so thanks for texting us, Jane. She is saying, someone told us downy woodpeckers cannot taste, so they put cayenne pepper on the grape jelly to keep squirrels away. Is this true? And how about Oreos? Do they taste? Thank you. Jane from St. James.
Hey, Jane. Thank you. They put cayenne pepper on things primarily to keep squirrels from eating them.
Oh.
So birds can certainly taste things, but they don't have the developed taste buds, so to speak, that we have, so they do not notice the cayenne pepper that's on seeds. And I still worry that if I'm just sprinkling it on there, they might get something in their eyes or something. So I did try it once a company that produced seed with a cayenne on there, and my squirrels just loved it. I don't know. They just, apparently they like spicy foods because they were eating it. So that particular one didn't work. But I've read a lot where people swear by it, that squirrels will leave it alone. The birds will eat it with no problem, don't even notice it. So, Jane, that is very true. And that'd be true of all the birds you've mentioned there, that they just don't have they just don't taste it. So, that'd be sad, wouldn't it? Not being able to taste hot, spicy foods. And I grew up in a family where ketchup was an exotic spice. That was about as hot as we got. So
that's cool.
Hey, Mayton, bunch of nice folks and great questions today. So I really appreciate y'all. And thanks for sitting on the front porch with us. I was thinking the other day, at least I wasn't the guy who told me he'd bitten himself on his forehead. I asked him, how was that possible? And he said, I was on a ladder. And then he didn't finish his story. But, boy, you bit yourself on your forehead. I don't think you can do that. I really don't.
So.
Unless you have false teeth, maybe. And even better, I wasn't a fellow who went to a doctor who told him the bad news. He had little time left. And, of course, the patient asked, how much time? 10, said the doctor. 10 days, weeks, months, years, asked the patient. 9. 8, 7, said the doctor. I had a hitch in my get-along. My problem is I can never remember which knee is my bad knee now and which one is my good knee, because they both kind of feel about the same. And I've talked about Doc Olds and Doc Buttriff, the small-town physicians of my youth who kept me going. I've talked about them a lot because they're both so important. I wouldn't be here, I don't think, if it weren't for those fine doctors. But Marion Ball, who listens from Faribault, sent this. She said, my childhood physician was Dr. Rumpf. When called out at night, he would fly through all the stop signs and then send a check to the police department to cover any transgressions. And whenever my mom would take me in for some ailment or stitches, he would tell her, just sell her to the circus. Remember, folks, heartlessness while we're driving past. Do something wild today. Get out there and look at a bird. Karen, as always, thank you for your fine company. Weather's coming, because weather's always coming, but, boy, it's a beautiful day right now. So get outside and put some steps on.